You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
This program is a theoretical account of the events that occurred on April the 14th, 1865, and thereafter. Although written history has recorded the death of John Wilkes Booth 12 days later at Garrett's Farm on April the 26th, 1865, there are many that believe his ending is unresolved. Vanished is recorded in its entirety with the Zoom H1N microphone. Get yours now at zoom-na.com. And now, we've reached the end. In part 4, I mentioned that we've covered this case in essence 2 times. The John Wilkes Booth story represents, for me, a very big struggle for the show, because we had to change the structure midway through research, and just before we were set to launch an entire season based on the case you just heard. Now that it's behind us, I feel a weight lift, because we were able to keep our promise and deliver the case we started working on so long ago. And now it's reflection time. If you've been listening to this series, you'll know that we had some very special cameo appearances throughout our investigation. The roles of John Wilkes Booth and Vice President Andrew Johnson were played respectfully by a returning Montgomery Sutton and R. Bruce Elliott from the incredible 1865 podcast. If you haven't heard that show, check it out. It's been in the show notes for every episode in this series. As we exit our journey into 1865 and John Wilkes Booth, I find it only fitting to end with the first roundtable discussion we've ever done on this show. And it features the creators and writers of 1865, Eric Archilla and Stephen Walters, along with myself and Jen, and a returning Dave Taylor, as we discuss our coverage of the case, the assassination of Lincoln, the radicalization of John Wilkes Booth, and how the events of 1865 serve as a striking parallel to what we're all living through right now in modern times.
Never seen my friends feel sad.
It's weird, you know, like everybody's heard the term, everybody listening to this will hear the term elephant in the room. They've heard that before, I'm sure. I feel like this story, there's several elephants in this room. And I want to dive right into the most obvious question that I can think of. It's one that Jen and I talked about throughout the show a little bit here and there, and even offline. Is there a historical parallel between the events of 1865 minus the assassination, but between the events of 1865 and the events of 2020 coming into 2021 now? And Eric, we'll begin with you on that if you want.
Oh, absolutely. You have the outgoing, very progressive president followed by a very conservative president seeking to outdo, undo everything that they did in office. You have that president coming in is very populist, definitely appeals to the kind of the lower class of the South and kind of gathering their votes, kind of garnishing their votes to succeed. You have an impeachment that is centered around, again, Congress going to war with the president. And then this most recent second impeachment where we have a president that is accused of riling up people against Congress, calling for violence, whether the president actually called for violence or not. Violence did happen. The crowd was incited. And so we have a lot of parallels. Steve, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because when Eric and I first started working on the play Booth, once we sort of, you know, we obviously it started as a research paper in college, and then we kind of resuscitated it, brought it back to life, and tried to make a real play out of it. This was during the Obama administration that we began working on it. And it's interesting because I remember people saying to us, we would sit in the play out to get feedback and to try to set up readings at theaters. A lot of people would say to us that a story about the rise of white supremacy was not relevant. And I remember thinking, oh, you must not live in the South. Because what I was experiencing as somebody who was, you know, making theater and art in Texas was that this was simmering, that there was a backlash to President Obama, not just to his progressivism, but to the color of his skin. I think that backlash, it was, you know, it was complicated. It wasn't just about race for any one person. I don't mean to try to paint the right with a, you know, monolithic brush, but certainly race was a major component of that pushback. It started with the rise of the Tea Party, and that continued on into this populist movement that I think President Donald Trump really became, you know, the face of. But I think the parallels and similarities even extend into 2020 and say 1868. You know, I mean, just look at the transfer of power that happened in 1868. I mean, you've got the rise of the KKK in the election of 1868, terrorizing the freedmen down south, raping, pillaging, wreaking havoc on not just the people of color down south and trying to disenfranchise them, but also on white Republicans who are down in the South trying to, you know, restore order and maintain the peace and keep the peace in the wake of the Civil War. So you've got this white nationalist Ku Klux Klan movement happening down south in direct reaction to the progressive policies the newly elected president Ulysses S. Grant is going to carry forward, you know, kind of continuing the policies of, you know, Abraham Lincoln, whose time was cut short. And then, you know, you have a populist president in Andrew Johnson who stubbornly refuses to attend Grant's inauguration, who in his final days in office pardons Booth's conspirators. You know, the very men who were acting on behalf of this white nationalist movement. You've got the threat of potential violence in Washington and in the surrounding areas.
And I think we should take a second. We get a lot of backlash on our show for likening modern Republicans to Democrats of the 1860s. But I think it is important to note that when you look ideologically at the two parties, and we get a lot of flack for this, but it's just the historical truth, that they have switched ideologically, that you went from a states' rights, small government, Southern party, which was the Democrat Party. Yes, there was Democrats in the North as well, but predominantly in the South. And then you have a Northern party that was more about wanting free labor, and they were definitely pushing progressive ideas when it came to either abolition of slavery or suffrage for Blacks. Now, when we look at modern society, we have the Democrat Party, which is pushing for those liberal ideas. And you look at the insurrection that happened on the Capitol. These were small government people that did not trust the government, that were predominantly from the South. And you just simply have to look at who is waving the Confederate flag nowadays.
And again, I mean, Eric and I are both from the South. We understand that not all conservatives, not all Republicans subscribe to that particular populist nationalist brand of Republicanism. And we also know that you can't paint anything with a broad brush, right? Like even the Republicans of the 1860s did have a lot in common with some, you know, I would say neoconservatives of today, in the sense that, you know, they were very friendly to Wall Street. They were very friendly to big business. So it's not, you know, it's not a binary proposition, but Eric is right that the sort of some of the overarching movements behind these parties have really sort of switched.
And when you look at John Wilkes Booth specifically, he is more in like with the people that were angry about feeling like the election was stolen from them than anyone else. He ideologically felt like the country stood an existential threat from Lincoln's election.
Yeah.
And he had to take action.
Is Booth was a member of the Know Nothing Party for a while, I know.
The Know Nothing Party. Like, and also, as you guys talk about the Knights.
Yeah, Knights of the Golden Circle.
Yeah, it's just interesting because I think Booth in that way is a political, he's politically agnostic, right? I mean, his allegiances tend to shift in terms of like which faction he is aligned with in any given moment. But the through line is this sort of, antebellum idea of what the country is supposed to be, this idea that's very much rooted in the cause of slavery.
You know, Jen, I don't think I ever asked you this. When we talked about it, I had this question like in my mind, and since Eric and Stephen brought it up, I'll ask you to give your thoughts first on this. What do you think John Wilkes Booth specifically would think about the insurrection and modern day events? Would he support that? Do you think that's
he'd have been there? I've always thought that, like, he would have been there. He would have been shaman guy standing like he's I mean, you know, he's so dramatic and narcissistic, like that kind of personality mixed with that kind of extremism. Like, he would have been making TikToks. Yes, he would have been on Parler and on like he all in it. Yes.
Yeah. I completely agree. He would have been wearing eyeliner for sure.
Yes,
that's too much. That's too funny. Well, you know, you guys have been neck deep in this for a long time, much longer than Jen and I have been, but you know, obviously you've heard of the aspect of the story that we're discussing in this series, you know, the Booth escape theory. I just want you guys to give your general thoughts on that theory. I mean, now that you guys have heard some of the show, I know our trial by jury is not dropping till later tonight, so you won't hear that yet. You won't have the benefit of hearing that before this conversation, but what are your thoughts on that general theory?
I'll let Eric handle this one, but I will say this, you know, in our many years of research and experimenting and creating inside this space, obviously we have come across a treasure trove of conspiracy theories. This story is riddled with them. And we tipped our hats to a lot of them. We embraced some of them and wove them into the action of 1865 and, you know, experimented and toyed with what those conspiracies meant. But I don't believe that there's any chance in hell that he escaped. I mean, I think it's just that. It's a conspiracy theory. I'll let Eric chime in because I know he's very studied on this question.
Yeah, so we have some personal interest in this because we're both actors in Texas. So the John St. Helens story is certainly close to home since Granbury Opera House is not too far from where we live.
What is that, Eric? Can you kind of just give us the sort of 3,000-foot view of what that theory is?
Oh, it's that Booth did not die in the barn from what they've talked about in the show. And I don't want to rehash for all your listeners because they've heard it all. But that Booth did not die in the barn, that he actually escaped before another gentleman came in, and that Booth made his way down south, that he then took the name of a man named John St. Helens, who on his deathbed admitted that he was actually John Wilkes Booth, but then he didn't die. And then he continued to live out his life, traveling around the country, various places under several other aliases, ended up dying. And the gentleman that he admitted it to earlier on recovered his body and then wrote a book about how it was John Wilkes Booth.
That's it. That's a great summary. Yes, that's what we've been arguing for the last, Nate has been arguing, Nate and his team.
We have not been arguing this.
Yeah, Nate has been arguing it. I have been advocating for Nate and his team and because of some of the stuff that's pretty compelling and interesting that they've put forward. But I think after you guys listen to the trial by jury piece, it's could change everything for the way the show is structured and everything. There's so much to talk about with that, but I think Jen and Dave respectively did an amazing job at sort of countering that theory, countering Nate's, what Nate's putting forward. But, Nate's been working on this for 50 years. I mean, he's very studied on it himself. You know, he's also all in on it. So he thinks that that's what happened.
I have a sort of random tidbit that I did not think I was going to talk about today, but it just sort of like popped into my head and I feel like I'm just going to say it. And it's about John Wilkes Booth and about who he was and, you know, who if John Wilkes Booth would have been storming the Capitol in 2020, you know, who are those people that were there storming that Capitol? And what do they say? Because they are part of us. They are a reflection of our country and of our culture.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is controversial. I don't know if I'll get in trouble for saying this. I certainly don't think that John Wilkes Booth is a victim. I certainly don't romanticize what John Wilkes Booth did. I mean, I see it clear-eyed for what it was. It was murder. It was insurrection. It was assassination. And I certainly don't think that the people that stormed the Capitol were within their rights to do that. I mean, I think that was horrific in every sense. But I do think a lot of those folks, and to an extent, some of the people that probably had common cause with John Wilkes Booth in the 1860s are victims.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's controversial, but I do think that they're victims. They're victims of propaganda. They're victims of misinformation. They're victims of an economic power structure that is designed to subjugate them in perpetuity. And it seems that they don't know it. You know, it seems that they don't realize it. And I get like, there's this movie, this Tom Hanks movie called News of the World. Have you guys watched it? What did you think of it, Chris? Did you like it?
Yeah, it was powerful stuff.
Eric, you should watch it. It's about a Civil War, a Confederate Civil War officer who Tom Hanks plays, who after the war is a newsman, basically. He travels from town to town reading the newspaper to illiterate people, telling them about what's happening in the world. And one of the things, and he ends up coming across, it's almost like the plot of The Mandalorian. He comes across this young girl who was kidnapped by Indian tribes and raised by the Indians. And basically she's abandoned out in the wilderness and he has to take her back to her aunt and uncle. And it's a journey about them. It's set in Texas. And, you know, he's taking her through the South, trying to get her down by, I think, San Antonio way. But one of the ideas that that movie lifts up that I have been grappling with for some time, especially since January 6th, is just this idea that a lot of the people in the South were fighting in a rich man's war. You know, they themselves were not the beneficiaries of the evil that was slavery. They were just chattel. Is that the right word?
Yeah,
I mean, they're farmers. They're farmers and ranchers, and the very existence of slavery makes economically actually things worse for them.
Yes.
Because the rich plantation owners are able to make a product much cheaper. And so the only reason why they would be against the abolition of slavery is a racist view that the freedom of blacks is going to make their lives worse.
Yeah. And it's just interesting to me, because if you take like the thing that many of the people who storm the Capitol are afraid of, which is this radical new America, which is just another way of saying that people of color will be in positions of power and that the starting line of, you know, opportunity in our country will be more even between gender and race and, you know, sexual orientation and all those things. It's interesting because it's like the thing that they're afraid of would actually benefit a good majority of those folks and of their folks, right? Of their family and their friends and their communities, you know, opportunities baked into the system, you know, for disenfranchised folks or for folks who don't have, you know, trust funds and for folks who don't have access to Ivy League educations, this populist thing that's driving them. It's like they are rallying around men like Donald Trump against, ideas that would benefit them. And that's always struck me as just being so interesting. They're being
lied to. No, you're absolutely, because people are being lied to and they've been being lied to for decades. I mean, if you're at the absolute bottom, you are a poor white person barely struggling to survive, but in your mind, there's another group of people that's below you. You feel threatened when that group threatens to overtake.
Yeah.
And there's
equality looks like oppression when you come from a place of privilege. That's the quote that a good friend of mine told me.
There's a jaw-dropping article in the Bedford Gazette, I think it's 66, that just talks about what's going to happen when the freedmen are marrying your sister and serving on your jury and living in your neighborhood. And it's just complete fear that they're stirring of what that's going to do. And then you have men like John Wilkes Booth. This is actually one of the reasons why I think the escape theory is so preposterous, is because one of the quotes that I totally forget his name. What's the third alias that he died under?
David E. George.
On his deathbed, he says, "I killed the greatest man that ever lived." And I can't imagine John Wilkes Booth ever having those words come out of his mouth that Lincoln was great.
I mean, is it possible he could have repented at that time? Is it possible he could have regretted it? Is it possible that, you know, it weighed heavily all throughout the years and he wanted to get it off his chest? Is that possible?
If we want to talk about conspiracy theories, the greatest conspiracy theory is how the South was able to write history from the aftermath of the Civil War and that we're still battling with that today. The South rewrote history to be the lost cause narrative that the Civil War was not about slavery, and they have controlled that history since 1872 and even before, and we're still seeing
the repercussions of that. And controlled what, and you know this, Eric, I mean, you're a teacher, controlled the content of what was in textbooks.
Yeah.
And the way in which American history is taught.
Texas textbooks nowadays don't even mention slavery. They call it forced migrant labor or something. It's like, come on, people.
It's like, no, that George Carlin
skit. Acknowledge that slavery existed and own up to it.
I grew up, I mean, I've lived in Texas my whole life. I grew up being told by adults in my life that if you hear that the Civil War was about slavery, that's just people lying to you. Like, that's just wrong. That's not what it was about at all. Like, these are things that I was told as a child.
Yeah.
And my response to that is always, well, don't take my word for it. Read their words. Read the articles of secession from each of those states. It'll tell you everything you need to know about why they did it. It's right there, plain as day.
Which brings us to one of the conspiracy theories about the assassination, which is that Edwin Stanton was behind the whole thing. Which is completely driven by Southern people that hate Edwin Stanton. In all of our research, it's preposterous. I mean, Edwin Stanton gained nothing by Lincoln dying. In fact, he was very personally close to Lincoln. He hated him when he was before he became war secretary, and then they grew very fond of each other.
Yeah,
and I think Stanton, although in fairness to Lincoln, I think Stanton just hated everyone.
Yes, he did. He was a curmudgeon.
He was just an angry person.
Yes, he was. Well, you know, moving on for the sake of, you know, trying to get all the topics we want to cover into the conversation, Mark Zaid said multiple times on our show that the very reason we're doing this podcast right now for Vanish, it proves what he was saying 26 years ago in the trial that they in 95, and that there is almost an unwavering uncertainty that clouds the story, you know, in particular, the John Wilkes Booth escape theory story. And until we do something about it, that uncertainty will remain there. I'm wondering if I can get everyone's thoughts on that. And Jen, I'll ask you to start.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be honest. Like, I get that. I get where he's coming from. Like, he's literally telling us, like, well, you're doing a podcast on it. So obviously, like, it's still a conversation and we can put an end to this conversation now. But I kind of take a different view of us. Like, we're doing this. And at least whenever I think what my role in this is to show that it's not legitimate. Like, to so that people will stop talking about it as being this legitimate alternative that we should have a conversation about. Because at the end of the day, if you look at it with a microscope and you look at what they're actually relying on, none of it's reliable, none of it's credible. We don't have a legitimate historical question that would necessitate digging up remains, you know, doing destructive DNA testing. I'm not trying to compare Vanish to like History's Mysteries and Mummies Unwrapped and Unsolved Mysteries and all of those. Those are great shows. I think what we do is a little bit different, but just because something shows up on Unsolved Mysteries does not make it a legitimate historical question.
I don't see the reason why they can't simply just test the spine just to put it to rest. I don't understand why they can't just do that.
Thank you, Eric. I'll Venmo you later.
Taking an ounce or two of the spine is like me walking through the museum. I'm not going to look at the spine and go, oh, it looks really amazing. I'm glad I could see this. But man, that missing ounce of the spine just really infuriates me.
It's the principle of the matter.
Listen, run the goddamn test. Okay, run the test and put this to bed.
This is a family show, Chris.
No, it's not. Not anymore. Run the test. That's my position. I agree 100% with Mark Zaid on that. Like, absolutely run the test. Put it to bed forever, one way or another, because the crazy thing, and this is a conspiracy buff in me. What if you run the test and it happens to go in Nate's favor? Then what do you do at that point? And I worry about that.
Then a lot of people are going to make a lot of money on some books.
Yeah,
exactly. But I legitimately worry about that, because if Nate's wrong, he's wrong. And that's that. But if he's right, or if there's any semblance of accuracy to the story that he's telling, then you have to open a whole nother can of worms. It does rewrite history to a certain extent. And so that's why I feel like I agree with Eric. I mean, I don't see a harm. 0.2 grams now, they're even saying, our very own DNA experts on the show that we had on said, you could even cut the 0.4 grams in half that they were talking about doing in 2013.
But Zaid also said that he doesn't believe, based on the research he's done, that it was preserved properly. So that even
they're always going to find a reason.
Tests,
That's very true.
And I have a very legitimate concern that the escape theorists are kind of setting up a response if the tests don't go their way.
Right.
You know, I am concerned about that. And I am concerned about, like, okay, there's a possibility that A, we could do the test. It doesn't prove them right, but they don't accept it as proving them wrong either. And now we've opened the door by setting a precedent for any conspiracy theorist that wants to come forward and like rewrite what, you know, they do their own version of revisionist history. It then opens the door to allow them to start messing around around with our historical artifacts, and I'm uncomfortable with that.
Which that brings me to my answer for your first question, which is it's very, I mean, the parallels to what we're talking about right now with election fraud are just stark.
The 1776 report.
When you talk about, like, you start with what you believe, and then you look at the evidence and make it fit what you believe. When I say we should test the spy, it's because I want to put it to bed. I'm tired of hearing about it.
Agreed.
But I do not believe in any way that Booth escaped. And people that believe that theory, it's like Occam's razor. Like, the simplest solution is all of the evidence we've already seen. And when you have to refute every single piece of evidence, and the excuse for this piece of evidence is this, and the excuse for this piece of evidence is this, and you're having to undo every single bit of information and doing that much work to disprove something, to me, that just seems
a silly endeavor. I agree with Eric. I mean, this is such a complicated, I have so many thoughts about this. And I guess I feel that the burden of proof is on the conspiracy theorists.
Yes.
That's what I believe. Just generally, because those of us who, you know, want to rely on fact and reason and scientific process, while we don't have anything to fear from any of those processes, whether it be a DNA test, exhuming a body, whatever it is, we don't have anything to fear about those things because we have fact and reason on our side. I don't know. I don't see that there's anything intrinsically wrong with it. But it does make me uncomfortable. You know, it's like, for the reasons that Eric just articulated, you look at, I don't know, QAnon, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at what QAnon is, you know, it's a story that never ends. You know what I mean? They move the goalpost perpetually. And it's kind of what you just alluded to. It's like, okay, well, if this thing happens, then there'll just be a pivot that will take place and the goalpost will move again. And then now we'll be defending against a new thing. I mean, it's almost like if you watch political debates in recent years, like in the age of social media and the age of information, it's very difficult for people who are arguing fact to succeed in making a point, because often what the strategy that's implemented on the other side, and I don't mean to subscribe this to Republicans or Democrats, I just mean in a debate, there's one person arguing fact, there's another person arguing conspiracy. The person arguing fact is at a disadvantage because the conspiracy theorist can sort of pepper the conversation with like, I don't know, like a blitzkrieg of all sorts of different things. And then you have to, like, if you give to even like acknowledge that one of those things means that your progress is stopped, like you're frozen in time. And then you have to sort of like parse out each individual idea. And you don't even get to the greater truth that you're moving towards. Does that make any sense, Eric? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Steve and I, in researching for our story, view things from we're taught this in theater. We view things from a very, very simple character perspective, which is, would that person do that? would Stanton have orchestrated that Lincoln would be killed? No, absolutely not. Would Johnson have wanted to punish the South? No, absolutely not. Would Booth have gone years and years knowing everything we know about him with not talking about what he did? No, sorry. Yeah.
I think it's what you're talking about is basically critical thinking, right? I mean, I think that there is a dearth of critical thinking in our popular culture and in our society right now, right? I mean, I think that in the new age of information, the sort of new, evolutionary proposition is, will you be able to use critical thinking to arrive at a reasonable conclusion about the information that you're being inundated with?
Meme culture has really harmed that. Yeah.
And if we want to get more into the nitty gritty, the evidence, like when we talk about personalities, Edwin Stanton was a lawyer and very, very detail oriented. People talk time and again about how organized he was. He is, in my opinion, the reason we won the Civil War. Because when he took over the war office, his organization and communication helped us to win the war. The second that he found out about Lincoln's assassination, what did he do? He immediately moved his office into the Peterson House. He called every single witness because he knew, as a lawyer, we need to document as much information as we can, as quickly as we can, because he knew that witnesses that wait are going to be tainted in their testimony. And he wanted that testimony immediately.
Yeah. We talked about that and during our trial of the witnesses that wait. Since Dave has joined us, Dave, you might be the only one besides Jen, myself, and of course our engineer TJ that's mixing the show that have really heard Trial by Jury for the most part in its entirety. Is one segment that we're adding in today. But in retrospect, you know, what are your thoughts on your overall experience here? I mean, we talked offline way back when we were originally going to do this piece, and we had to sort of do an audible on it. But I know you were a little hesitant to come on, understandably. I mean, it's a tough show to guest on sometimes, but you ended up playing really a major role in sort of how we told the story. I mean, give me your thoughts and everything going back now.
Yeah, it really was the format that that changed my mind on the whole thing. Because when you first approached me way back then, at first I was like, no, don't really want to do it, because the story of like the Booth Mummy and everything, it's, in my mind, it's overdone. It's all the media that we see, all the TV documentaries, they're all about it. And I mean, there was the one that just aired the end of last year, and there's another one with William Shatner that's going to be doing it, and the pre-production there has already contacted me. So with me, it's like, this is what always gets the attention, and it's frustrating as historian to see, in my mind, bad history being given all of the attention and putting it on a pedestal that makes it seem just as reliable as actual history. So at first I was very much like, I don't know if I want to do this, but it was the piece that you have, the trial by jury and the expertise of Jen, that really turned me around, being like, this is something that I know, you know, isn't going to be the 45 minute, you know, TV documentary that just throws all the sensationalism at you because that draws people in, but that, you know, the podcast form, you know, gives you the ability to really dive in deep, as, you know, the 1865 podcast does. And that's what makes it unique and really changed my mind, that it's still a form of popular entertainment, but you really can get to the meat and potatoes, which is what history really deserves.
Granbury, yeah. Texas, John Wilkes Booth.
Yep.
I can't believe Shatner's doing that. That's awesome.
Yep, he sure is.
Yep, yeah, he's
Shatner. Your Shatner, Eric, your Shatner kind of sounds like Christopher Walken.
Well, Christopher Walken is more like this. This is Christopher Walken than how he sounds.
This is definitely going into the final track. Just want to let you know that.
Gotta have more cowbell.
Yeah, for
real. Yes.
So, Jen, let's talk about your side of that equation, then bringing Dave in. I mean, you had off-air conversations with Dave, you know, once I sort of told you about him really early on, and you had an initial conversation, and then now you guys worked pretty close together, like to basically put him on the stand, quote unquote, to kind of like basically refute some of the stuff that Nate was putting out. Talk about that experience. Talk about how you guys work together. What are your thoughts in retrospect here?
Oh, Dave, you saved me, like, because I was so lost. Like, I had no clue. I mean, it's just so much information. And I remember, like, whenever I first heard that we were doing this, it really did feel very overwhelming, because I know jack shit about this topic.
A family show.
You're right. Right.
But I was told earlier that I could curse. So I'm doing it now.
It's passionate.
No, I'm very, 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 very grateful for your help, Dave. Like, seriously, like, it was really, really fun to be able to just like go through all of this stuff, like learn everything. And like, honestly, like, I've done this before with other topics, but it was different, right? Because like with Amelia Earhart, the Tiger organization did us a huge favor by like putting all of their garbage on like one website, right? And like, there isn't the equivalent of that and for this. And so I truly don't think that we would have like the show that we would have without Dave's help. And so I'm going to publicly thank you for that.
Oh, yes. You're too kind, Jen. You would have gotten there. It's all that nitty gritty stuff, because it looks so appealing on the face of it, which is why Nate gets so many converts in this, because it's a cool story with a mummy and you listen to it and everything they say sounds legitimate. But if you don't have the expertise or the knowledge of how to peel back those layers,
it's
then
so it's hard to find that stuff too. Like, yes. Like some of the stuff that Dave was able to send me and look at, these are not things I would have been able to find by Googling it. So I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't had like somebody that actually knows this stuff, like helping me out.
Yeah. Dave's, your site is like a treasure trove of information on Lincoln and on Booth, really Booth specifically. And it's like, you know, having someone like that on the show is extremely helpful for the overall narrative. And it talks about, you know, we started this whole show with talking about the Lucy Lambert Hale, the Valentine. And I want to ask you guys, Eric and Steven, about that. Can you give us more information on the Valentine? Tell us how you guys discovered that initially? Tell us a little bit of background, or as much as you can, about Lucy Lambert Hale and her potential, you know, or her involvement with Booth, and just kind of where that stretches and where that stops.
Well, the Valentine's pretty well known. And when we first dived into back in college, when we decided not to write a research paper on 18th century theater and 19th century theater, and instead chose the Booth family, the letter was pretty easy to find. And that's kind of one of the first things that we kind of steered towards, was that relationship that we don't hear much about. It's pretty well historically documented. A lot of people talk about that private relationship that they had, that secret engagement. Booth apparently wore the ring and played with it a lot. He had written to his mother and his brother talking about the engagement, and no one denied in the Booth side that they were engaged. The only people denying it were the people that were ashamed that she was engaged to him, and had a reason to cover that up after, like her father, John Parker Hale, and obviously Edwin Stanton.
But like a lot of things in this story, there is a dearth of information about that relationship. We don't know much about Lucy and John. I mean, we know, I remember there was one story that's pretty well documented that they got in a big fight when they were on a trip together. I don't know, but I don't even know if that story is true. I mean, the thing is there's more that we don't know than we do. Like a lot of the stuff surrounding this story, you know, in 1865, we certainly make a meal out of Lucy's relationship to Robert Lincoln, but that's something that there's very little information out there about. I mean, we know that Lucy was the belle of Washington, as they say. We know that she was being courted, and we know that there was some talk of Robert and Lucy. But certainly the version of it that we portray in 1865 is, you know, as we say in the business, it has some stank on it. It's a little bit of dramatic flair to make the story good. But I'd be curious to hear Dave's thoughts on this love triangle, and, you know, what's fact and what's fiction, and what do we know and what do we not know?
Yes, tell us, Dave.
Well, I mean, I think you guys are absolutely, you hit the nail on the head. There definitely was a relationship between the two of them. And, you know, we don't have a lot of evidence, but Booth himself, I mean, he tells his own brother, Junius, about, you know, he spends... My interesting thing with the Valentine, and I actually asked Chris off air if he could send me the one that you both mentioned, because I've heard of this one. Like you said, it's not a hidden thing. However, I've never been convinced that Valentine is actually from Booth, the one that's stranger, because the evidence that I have, he couldn't have known her at the time that he wrote that. He does write a Valentine for her, and it's mentioned by the brother in 1865. Junius says Wilkes stayed up all night writing a Valentine for Miss Hale. And so there was a relationship from them. And you're right, there's those other stories about them getting into a fight, them going to another hotel. I'm not convinced that Booth was even the Booth. But my romantic part of me, like, you add a little stank to it, is that in Booth's diary, when he's on the run, you know, he's escaping out, it's his manifesto that he writes everything in. We always talk about, you know, the big chunk of text where he talks about, you know, I said sic semper before I fired. I rode 50 miles with the broken bone of cutting into my leg. He has all this thing about this heroics that he did. And he wrote that in his diary because it was going to be his last word. But we always ignore the first two words that he writes in his diary, which are te amo, which is I love you. And Lucy's father, as you guys know, was becoming the ambassador, you know, to Spain. And we have the idea that they were studying Spanish together. And so I always look at it as, even though it seems like such a, you know, a long, you know, pull, but I honestly feel that that was his coded message to the woman he loved. He felt bad what he had done. And that was for her. Everything else was for posterity about how great I am. But those two words, the beginning of his diary, was him still saying, I love you. And, you know, I'm sorry for what I did.
And was even after that fact, the family lamenting, like Edwin Booth talking about how she would have gone to the gallows for him.
Yes.
They still talked about her.
Dave, what about this story about Lucy's at a high society event? She's dancing with Robert, and Booth cuts in. Any truth to it?
No, I know there's a pamphlet by a gentleman who actually lives here in Southern Maryland, and he wrote about the love triangle, you know, between Robert Todd Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth and Oliver Wendell Holmes and things like that. And she was definitely popular with all of them. But I think even that booklet, which came, it's based on some newspaper accounts that I think were very much just exaggerated years later. But there was a connection. Like, I've seen an actual book that Robert Todd and another gentleman gave to Lucy and inscribed to her, that's in private hands. So there definitely was a relationship. They knew each other. They at least were friendly enough, and she was popular enough that maybe, but I think the ideas of, it really was this, you know, this conflict of interest in that. That's why Booth hated Lincoln so much, because he was, they were coming after his girl. I think that's just added drama. That,
well, the we talked about elephants in the room at the beginning of the episode. The thing that Stephen, yeah, I think is hilarious is that her husband then served on the same cabinet as Robert Lincoln. Yes.
Yeah. What was that? William, yeah, Chandler? Is that who it is?
Yes,
William
Chandler. Chandler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a small world. It really is.
Well, Washington City was a small world, right? I mean, it was, what, yeah, 3,000 residents at that time? I don't exactly know the number.
I'm not sure either, but it definitely, it was so small, and then it swelled during the Civil War, but still such a small town compared to what we picture it as the metropolitan area today.
So Dave, I want to ask you about, and we talked about this in Trial by Jury, Nate brought it up, and I think we talked about it in part three. It's all starting to just meld together now, but let's talk about the Andrew Johnson note, the note that potentially Booth left for Johnson. I want to really get the whole room's opinions on this note, because we talked about this in part one. It intrigued me, obviously, because you have Lincoln dying this horrible, slow, terrible death, and then you have Secretary Seward, who was stabbed upwards of a dozen times, and, you know, just a very terrible situation that was. And then Johnson sort of getting a note. I want to ask about that aspect of the whole thing. Do you think they really fully intended to kill Johnson? Do you think there's anything to that note being a tip off of any kind? I mean, straighten me out. We'll let Dave start with that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Johnson was definitely a target. There's no doubt in my mind. And we have enough from George Atzerodt, the man who was supposed to kill him. When he's arrested, he just sings like a canary, because he's hoping, if I kind of turn state's witness and I just divulge everything I know, you won't put me on trial, because the rule of law back then is that if you were a defendant, you couldn't testify. So the only way that he would be allowed to testify is if they didn't make him a defendant and he was a witness. So he gave multiple statements, multiple confessions throughout his imprisonment, all hoping that they would use it and make him a witness. And instead they're like, thanks for the information, now enjoy the trial. So he definitely made it clear that Johnson was always going to be a target, and that, you know, he kind of downplayed that he was the one who was supposed to do it. He later was like, well, I said I wasn't going to do it. So Booth's like, well, Harold will do it, or he'll do it with you. He kind of tries to hedge his bets to protect himself. But there's really no doubt in my mind that Johnson was a legitimate target, because Booth really wanted to just decapitate the Union.
Eric, what do you think about that?
Well, I was going to say, Steve always talks about unreliable witnesses. Definitely Atzerodt and Harold were both unreliable witnesses. They're not going to say things that will incriminate themselves. So of course he's going to lie about his part in it. Harold's going to lie that the man in the barn is not Booth, or he doesn't know that it's Booth, even though we know that that is obviously a lie. And then you have Payne, Lewis Powell, who is the only person that doesn't ever fight to save himself, because he doesn't care. It's pretty obvious that he did what he did, and there were lots of witnesses there, and he was probably pretty proud of what he did.
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to what you used, Occam's razor, right? That you evoked that earlier. And I mean, I think, you know, reason says that, like Dave mentioned, that obviously Johnson was a target. I mean, certainly Johnson has I wouldn't even call it a political reversal. I think that, you know, he's a pretty straight line all the way through. You know, I mean, Lincoln chose Johnson to, you know, in a clear appeal to the people of the South, to try to show them that he was going to be a consensus builder and not punitive towards them. And that, you know, in the wake of the Civil War, he was trying to keep the border states from seceding. And, you know, it was a politically astute choice, but it was certainly not Lincoln chose Johnson because he was aligned with Johnson in their way of thinking about the world. I mean, you know, Lincoln forced Johnson to free his slaves, and the journey that Johnson takes after Lincoln is dead is the more interesting one, because then it gets into the question of, like, was Johnson a part of the conspiracy to kill Lincoln, kind of muddies the waters of the real question, which is, did Johnson collude with the Southern states to undermine the government, you know, to undermine the will of Congress and to flout the law and the rule of law in the country? And I think the answer to that question is probably, just like the sort of like Trump-Russia investigation, right? The waters get muddied when you start to add the conspiratorial element into the soup. Just look at Trump's actions on their face. There is in the Venn diagram of Vladimir Putin's geo-global goals and, you know, what Donald Trump did, there's a lot there, you know, yeah. The sort of like the weakening of NATO. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. And so you could say, all right, well, did Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin collude together? Did they collude to do something conspiratorial? Probably not. But was Trump trying to build an alliance with Vladimir Putin to sort of triangulate against China? Yeah, absolutely. And in the same way, it's like if you look at what Johnson did after Lincoln was dead as president, did he collude, or I don't know what word we should be using, but did he collaborate with the Southern state governments to try to readmit them into the union and further their agenda because it was similar? Yeah, absolutely he did. But it's like that conspiratorial element makes it feel very naughty when in fact it's really just politics as usual, you know?
Well, and to backtrack to something that was said earlier in your show, the people that back the Booth escape theory say that Johnson wanted to punish the South and that he was removing Lincoln because Lincoln was going to be too nice and he was going to be harder on the South. And again, that's just completely contradictory. But also you look at Johnson was the only senator of the South that did not back secession and actually stood a great deal of ridicule and hatred from his man. You can bet he was the one of these few Republicans that voted for the Trump conviction. They're getting a lot of hate mail and death threats. And that was Johnson.
The simplest explanation for Johnson, the reversal that I sort of almost got into earlier is that he went from being reviled by the people of the South to being championed by the people of the South. And the simplest explanation for what Johnson did with the Southern people and, you know, his liberal use of pardons and the potential impropriety that was baked into that transaction, I mean, the simplest explanation is that Johnson just enjoyed watching these people who had once turned their nose up at him sort of have to get down on their knees and kiss the ring. I mean, that's
and,
the simplest
and explanation. Give him money and bribe him and help him to.
Well, now there you go being conspiratorial again, Eric. Dave, did Andrew Johnson trade bribes for political favors?
I don't know, but I definitely agree with you saying. Yeah, I definitely agree with you when it comes to the pardons, because, you know, he pardons the three surviving Lincoln conspirators who got life sentences and are at Fort Jefferson. He doesn't have to do that. I mean, he has enough of a political cover to be like, oh, Dr. Mudd helped out with this yellow fever epidemic. But I'm with you that the only reason he did it, or the main reason he did it, and that he released the bodies of the executed conspirators and Booth back to the families was just a big middle finger to all the radical Republicans who had made his life like a living hell. And I agree with you that they muddied the waters when they tried to throw Lincoln's death at him. They were so eager to take him down any means necessary that when they did that, they lost credibility. And it's like, Johnson is guilty of a lot of things, but like the idea that he was part of it and they used that and tried to prove that in the impeachment hearings, I'm just like, you went too far and you ruined your own case.
Well, we've discussed a little bit the Valentine's note. We talked a little bit about that. We talked a little bit about the Johnson note. The other thing I wanted to really bring up that kind of stood out in the trial is the potential or just the idea that there was this password that existed, the TBTB road passer. I know that eye roll that Dave is giving me right now, but people will listen to this show sometimes in reverse, and I want to make sure that we cover some of the standout pieces. Dave,
tell us about the show in reverse. Who are these crazy people? We have hidden satanic messages in here if you play it backwards. Did you know that?
All is dead.
Don't play this one backwards. No, we have actually had people that say that they listen to the final piece first. They've had people that say they listen to trial by jury first. There's people that just listen to it, you know, 1 through 5. So it just
not recommended. Listen to it 1 through 5.
Yes, I agree, because it doesn't make sense if you don't do that. But to each his own. Dave, tell us about TBTB Road, please.
TB is a community in Prince George's County, and that's all that's relevant. Booth and Harold pass kind of through it. I think the problem is that people like Nate, they refuse to believe that the life is a little more chaotic than it really is. Like the idea, you know, it's hard for us to believe that one Lincoln could be shot. Like he also brought up, there's no security. Well, they didn't have it back then. I know that's crazy to us now. Like, I know that seems nuts. How does the president not have Secret Service or like protection? They just didn't, you know, it wasn't a concern. It wasn't something they felt wasn't really necessary, even in a time of war. And so it's this disconnect that we have with what life is now compared to what it was then that lead us to more, you know, what we think is a logical conclusion. Like, well, the only way they could have left Washington is if they had a password, because of course. But it just wasn't the case. And I know that seems like a cop-out because you're like, well, why are there even guards? But we have the guard who was there. And, you know, yes, the rule that was more hard and fast was no one can come into DC without a pass after 9 p.m. Those were the rules that were in effect. And yes, was there also a rule in effect saying you're not supposed to leave? Yeah, but the soldiers on patrol had some leeway. I know that seems, you know, people will be like, but it's military orders. He disobeyed military orders. But at the same time, it's the end of the war, essentially. You know, Richmond is gone. Lee has surrendered to Grant. The night before, the whole city was celebrating the grand illumination. The war is over. Everything is great. And so it might be hard for us to accept because it is circumstance. But Booth didn't need, you know, the idea that he had to have a guarantee to get out of Washington. I give him credit for a lot of this plan, but also it was very last minute. He was, this whole thing was to kidnap Lincoln. And then suddenly he's like, uh-oh, too late to do that now, I guess, kill him. And yeah, he had to throw it together. And so he wasn't able, it wasn't this big overarching thing that you need a password. They just talked their way past, because both of them did. If you had a reason to leave, they would have let you leave, but you couldn't come in unless you had a pass. And that was them still obeying the letter of their orders.
Yeah, that's what I agreed with the thing you said in the second episode, was that there was no reason why they would stop somebody from leaving. He just made it clear you couldn't come back in.
Well, Dave, were they in fact the only two people that left that night? We don't know, right?
Yeah, Nate said that multiple times. I doubt it. I mean, I don't know where he would even know that from, because the only reason we know these two is because these were the big ones. But as Jen and I said in the last part, you know, Fletcher, who is the stableman who David Harold has stolen his horse and is giving chase, he rides up to the soldier, Silas Cobb, and tells him, hey, you see a guy on this horse? And he's like, yes. He's like, I want to go chase after him. And Cobb, the sergeant on duty, says, you can go, but again, you're not going to be able to come back. So the idea that they were the only two who escaped, I'm pretty sure, I don't know how we'd know that. And there's so many forts out of Washington. It was guarded, but there's so many forts all around, and you pass through it. And to be honest, I know that's also not true to say the only one, because George Atzerodt, you know, our buddy who's supposed to kill Johnson, he granted gets drunk, doesn't do it, sleeps it off. And the next morning he gets up, rides to one of, you know, he catches a stagecoach to the line. It's still closed off, and he manages to talk his way across. So again, and this is after Lincoln's been shot and they kind of really closed down the city. So that guy who let him cross definitely got court-martialed. But the idea that no one else the night of Lincoln's assassination left the city seems kind of insane to me, as if there weren't other people just leaving the city. And, you know, it seems like such a normal occurrence, which is why Cobb and no one really investigated too much, because it wasn't unusual.
Yeah. And also going back to, since you brought up the Secret Service thing, this idea of the norms of the day being very different from the norms of our days is pretty obvious. Looking at the Secret Service, you know, General Grant, after he's elected president, this, you know, 3 years after the fact, he's on a train ride to Washington, and his train is essentially targeted. There's an attack. I mean, a lot of people don't know this, an assassination attempt on Grant's train. It's derailed, and people almost died, and Grant was almost killed. And they had instituted the Secret Service by the time Grant is president because Lincoln was killed. It was never a thing that they thought that they needed before. Lincoln certainly didn't want security. There were times where Stanton said, hey, maybe we ought to look into, you know, having some guards with you. And Lincoln was like, no, I don't want that. Grant didn't want the Secret Service. He, in fact, expressly ignored the rules that were put in place to protect him, because Grant felt that that was strange and weird, even after Lincoln had been killed, felt that he did not need Secret Service. I think it's just, the reason I bring that up is because I think Dave's point is absolutely right. The norms of the day of 1865 are not the norms of 2020, and comparing the two things is apples and oranges.
And then going back to what you said about what Cobb and Fletcher said, when we talk about witness testimony, their testimony was taken, was it the next day, I believe?
Yeah, statements were taken very quickly thereafter.
16th, I think, where they finally got Cobb and Fletcher. This is not the testimony of somebody in 1927 or whatever saying that they had this password and never told anybody else about it. It's, we're getting directly from the people that have no reason to lie, the direct testimony. There's no personal motivation for them to spin a story. They tell the truth that they know.
And what I love,
don't you just love this? Don't you just love this, Chris? How like I'm winning over here. Like,
all this I feel like the only quack in the room, but it's okay. It's okay. This is
you know, sitting here listening.
I know you have a big smile on your face. I can see. I know this is why we do what we do. You know, this is what we did with Earhart. We did with Jack the Ripper. It's what we'll continue to do with Avery, with DB Cooper, you know, pretty soon. We put these investigations out there, and you know, one of us is going to be wrong. Usually it's me. Usually someone's going to get crucified on the show. But that's sort of the nature of how we do it. Cause our whole thing is, you know, we don't want to one side this. Like, we want to just put the evidence out, put these experts on the stand, and we want to put, you know, these witnesses, you know, onto the show and everything. And we've always said this, you know, even publicly on, you know, when we do guest spots and stuff on other shows, like, you know, it's a very difficult show to guest on, because it's not a show that we're just going to agree with you 100%. Yes, there's somebody that's going to be advocating on your behalf and going through that process with you and all that, which is great. But it's going to be held very directly under a microscope, and it's going to be aggressive at certain points. And so people have to that are going to be sort of representing certain hypotheses and different cases and things and theories and all that, they have to be able to stand up to that. The evidence that they're presenting, it's not just talking about it casually. It's not just saying it in passing. Now you're going to have somebody saying, well, wait a minute, what about this? And what about this? And what about this kind of deal?
And Chris, I just want to tell you that I mentioned earlier before Dave got on, I was talking about critical thinking and how it's a skill that's lacking in our education system. And it's a skill that's lacking in our society. And I think what's great about your show is that it is an exercise in critical thinking. No matter what your opinion is about any of these questions, you're being asked to go through a process of critical thinking, to look at information, external stimuli, synthesize it into an opinion, and decide what it is that you believe about any particular question. And I think that that is extremely valuable. And I think it's very cool what you're doing, because even if you're certain, you're absolutely certain that what you believe is the truth, it's always great to vet what you think and be skeptical about what you think. That's part of the process of being a critical thinker, you know?
Yeah. I hope that's what comes across. I mean, I hope that's what people, listeners, get out of the show. And that's why we, you know, we always call it our listening jury, because that's what they're doing. They're basically listening to the show. They're listening to the evidence, the witnesses. And if you're sitting in a jury box and this is for real, what's going to sell you on something, you know, or what's going to sway you on certain things? We did, you know, Earhart, we went five different ways and multiple theories and everything. So it's, you know, it's tough. And then with Cooper, we'll go a different way, but you know, that's kind of the process of the show. So I'm glad that you are, you know, you see that the critical thinking aspect is in play, because that's really what we want to do. That's really what this is an exercise in, and just an exercise of arguing two sides, essentially, without people sort of standing in one corner, yelling at each other and saying, you have it wrong. You know, we want to put it out there and give people a fair platform. And if the evidence doesn't hold up, if it just caves in, sometimes it does, so be it, you know. And sometimes we've had the opposite happen, where, you know, we've had people on the show for different cases we're covering, and the evidence does hold up pretty solidly, or parts of the evidence does hold up pretty solidly. And, you know, and we can't poke holes in it, or it's difficult to, or whatever the case is. So it does go both ways, but sometimes it'll be an absolute disaster for one side or the other. But that's sort of the beauty and the tragedy in the show that we do, is like, you know, if you're going to come on, it's going
to
be
tough. We have such a hard time getting people to agree to talk to us. And
I cannot tell you how many people have dropped out.
And that's what I was going to say. Normally we'll get like a bunch of people that say that they will, and then they realize like what we do, and then they're like, actually, I don't know. And so like, it's scary for people to have to like face questions, hard questions. And so everyone that's ever come on, even if I like wildly disagree with them and I think that they're nuts, I'm not saying I think anyone's nuts in this situation, but I'm just, even if I did, I always respect somebody that's willing to get on the phone with me.
Jennifer, I'm nuts, but for very different reasons.
Yes. Well, that's, and that's that, therein lies sort of the rub in a way. Cause it's like, yeah, people like Nate, you know, I mean, I have an immense amount of respect for a guy who is just, he's been doing it for, I mean, 50, it's half a century. That's a long time. You know, it's like, he's dedicated to it. He believes it, you know, God bless him for that. I don't have a problem with that. And I love that he's able to come on the show and say, no, look, this is what it is. This is what I believe. This is what the evidence supports and all that stuff. And he's going back and forth. He spent over 2 hours on the, you know, on a call with Jen, and he spent, you know, more hours with me to kind of explain it. And I have a lot of respect. I mean, he's Nate especially, you know, hey, give people out my email. Let's talk about it. I'm happy to open a dialogue. There's a certain amount of respect you have to grant for that, because,
sure,
you know, some people do not do that. Oh, no, this is the truth. I know it's the truth in this particular case.
But I don't have anything to prove. That's what they always say. I don't have anything to prove. I'm not going to go on your show.
But I think it all comes down to who are the witnesses you're listening to? What information are you believing? All of the theory revolves around, do you believe Phineas Bates?
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at Booth's escape, you have a very clear, it's like when we talk about in a like a murder trial, Jennifer, you could probably talk about this, but when you talk about custody of evidence, having a clear custody of evidence of leading from one person to another and knowing that that evidence was secure, it's the same thing with Booth and Harold. We have a very clear timeline of who they talk to and when, and each person passing them from one to another until they get to the Garretts, who, from their perspective, don't ever say that it's a different person now in the barn, that a different person stayed there the night before. Now that they're a new person, they talk about how they locked them in the barn. Then the barn is surrounded. So there's a very clear line of evidence, and it's all from testimony of people that have no reason to lie about it. They obviously want that reward, but Stanton wants Booth in the ground, and he's not going to lie about it and say, oh yeah, we got him, just to be embarrassed later that Booth is still running around. Whereas Phineas Bates owns this mummy, doesn't say anything about this story about Booth until after the mummy is in his possession and after he writes this book.
Yeah.
So to me, that's very questionable.
I should have called you. I should have had you helping me too. Oh God.
We didn't need it to get any worse for my side at this point.
So I have a very cynical thing to say, which supports Eric's argument. This is kind of, I'm going to come around the bend here, but I write for a podcast called Business Movers, which is just a brand new podcast that came out on the Wondery platform just a couple of months ago. And we're doing a series on New Coke, the crazy story of Coca-Cola rolling out New Coke and then reversing course in 2 months, and the sort of backlash to New Coke and what that was all about. There's this writer who writes for Mother Jones named Tim Murphy. He wrote an article called New Coke Didn't Fail, It Was Murdered. And he tells the story, I know this sounds like I'm just completely off topic, but I'm not. He tells the story of this guy named Gay Mullins, who founded this corporation, which was basically an anti-New Coke movement, where he made t-shirts and he sold them and he borrowed over $100,000 of his own money and he put it into the effort to take out New Coke. But really, Gay Mullins was not who he said he was. He was not this man who just loved old Coke and like wanted to fight for true American values. What he really was kind of a grifter. And I think that the point that Tim was trying to make by telling the story of this man, Gay Mullins, is that sort of if you look just beyond the surface of, and I'm not saying of all conspiracy theories, but if you look just beyond the surface of many conspiracy theories, what you find is somebody trying to make a buck. And that's like QAnon is a great example of that. There are many, many examples of it, which I don't need to go into, and I'm running short on time. But I think that what you just alluded to is that there's always, right behind the surface, there's always a profit motive behind a lot of these things. I'm not saying that's true of any of your particular guests. I'm not trying to sling mud at anybody. But I'm saying that part of, I think, critical thinking, part of being skeptical about conspiracy theories is looking at the motivations behind the people who are peddling them.
Yeah, and Chris, I wasn't knocking people on your side at all. I was knocking the source that they're talking about.
Right.
Bates certainly had a reason to, and I mean, what does he do? He takes it to a carnival and shows it off, tries to show it off at the World Fair. He wasn't donating it to a museum and something credible.
He tried to sell it to Henry Ford.
He was selling tickets. Money. Yeah.
Yeah. And Henry Ford had it investigated and was like, nope, this is fake. And Henry Ford bought almost everything for his museum, but he was like, nope, this is fake. I'm not going to buy it.
And I mean, even John Surratt, right? Like when he does his sort of like after he comes back to the States and he's a free man and he does this sort of like lecture tour where he was undoubtedly getting paid large sums of money to make those first couple of engagements before it was shut down. But even Surratt sort of paints himself as being this kind of like master spy and, you know, that he was real plugged in to the CSS, the Confederate Secret Service. And it's like, was he really? Maybe. But is it possible also that Surratt was, you know, puffing himself up so that he could sell more tickets? Absolutely.
Well, with that, Stephen, well, I know you got to head out, but I really appreciate you joining the roundtable for part five. So thank you. We'll continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris and Jennifer. Thank you for having me. And Dave, it was really nice to meet you over the Zoom. I look forward to chatting more. I can't thank you all enough.
You know, regarding trial by jury and you know, that's coming out tonight. So that'll, you know, we talked with Mark Zaid. We talked about lots of things. You know, we won't go over it too much here, but I do want to ask the question because I did ask it to Jen. I asked it to Mark, I asked it to Nate, and I know their answers. But Dave and Erica, I'll get your thoughts on this. Having said everything we've said and knowing everything that we all know, you know, in our respective expertises and everything that we've gone through, is there a historical obligation to, and is there even maybe a moral obligation to, if we have the means and we have the ability to run this test, let's just suspend everything for a minute, run this test, put it to bed forever. I know Stephen talked about this a little earlier, but is there a moral and historical obligation to do so? Like if it potentially would change any part of history, regardless if Nate's right or if he's wrong, if the test can be done, minimal damage to any kind of existing sample, any of that stuff, and we can cross all those sort of marks, should we do the test? I mean, should we put it to bed? And I'll, Dave, I'll let you kind of take the floor on that.
My main opposition to it, really, because you just talked about moral obligation. My moral opposition to it is the desecration of the Booth family members' graves. That is really the line I do. And I know that seems like such a weird thing to do, but I mean, I do study Booth, but I study the rest of the Booths. I find them a fascinating family. They were this theatrical dynasty. You know, I've given speeches at Tudor Hall, their home in Harford County, Maryland, where, yes, John Wilkes Booth was raised, but also where his brother Edwin, who was the greatest Hamlet of all time, one of the greatest actors of his generation, and his father, Junius Brutus Booth Sr., was one of the greatest actors of his generation. And even the other siblings who maybe weren't as popular, but still good actors or just decent people in their own right, the way they suffered after what their brother did. I mean, it just this immense amount of misery and melancholy and just how this cloud of shame was over the Booths and the Booth name forever and will always be that way. I have my mind for me. I hate the idea of digging up any of them to justify in my mind this conspiracy theory. Like, and it's not that I don't want it to just go away. Lord knows I do. I mean, we'd make things a lot easier. There's so many more interesting stories that we can tell about Lincoln's assassination and the Booths than this. And I wish those would get the play that they deserve. But if you can find a way of doing it without disturbing any of the graves of the Booth family, that is when I would be more inclined to do it, just to put an end to it. But at the same time, I still feel like when you get pushed again, we are allowing unreliable sources and the QAnon of today, you know, maybe it's not the same thing, but still we're allowing that to call the shots. And I feel that's just a bad place to be in history, that is what, just to make them quiet, I feel like we open up a can of worms. But my major moral opposition is let the Booths rest in peace. They suffered enough in life, and I don't support the justification of desecrating them in death.
I don't think Dave could have said it better. I'm all about them taking a sample of the spine. I have no problem with that. I think that's silly to fight that. I think if they have another sample of, like, let's say at Edwin Booth's museum above the theater, if they have a lock of his hair or something that they could compare with, I'd be all about that. But I 100% agree with Dave on the fact that Edwin Booth was tortured enough in his life. I think exhuming him to do this test is really sad. I think that he should be kept at rest. He had kind of disavowed his brother early on. They had a huge fight during the, I believe, the riots in New York, the draft riots. And then Booth espoused some of his philosophies, and Edwin basically said, "You're not welcome in our house." Then obviously they got together and performed Julius Caesar in 64. But that was really one of the few times they made contact since that falling out. And he loved his brother, but he was very, it's like today, being very deeply concerned with family members that we're not talking to anymore because of our political differences, and loving them, but being really saddened by the rabbit hole they've gone down. I just think it would be really tragic to then exhume him for a conspiracy theory.
Jen, what do you think? We've been in this together now since the beginning. So what do you think? Have your thoughts changed since part one?
No, I think no. My big concern is that, yeah, we're setting a bad precedent. And given the times that we live in, I'm very uncomfortable with that.
Hypothetically speaking, if the mummy came back around, potentially the real one, like the one that they say is the mummy, not just a mummy, does that change anything for anybody on this call?
What are you comparing the mummy to? Because I have no problem with them dicing, slicing that mummy up. Again, it's cool little thing, but I'm like, you still need to compare it to something.
I'd be curious to test the mummy's DNA just in the typical test of knowing your country origin, because the Booths came from England. And so if that mummy doesn't have English DNA, or if it's got something else, you would immediately be able to question, is that mummy actually from the Booth family? They could test the spine for country of origin, and then look at the Booth family, look at their lineage.
Let's just brainstorm all the different ways that we can do DNA.
I mean, that would give them a ballpark of, I mean, if it shows, if they test it and it shows that it's German and or Scandinavian or something, and it's not not the lineage of the Booth family, that would be a red flag that it's definitely not the body or the
body.
I honestly you'd have to know test the reliability of those things. Like, even to this day, I know there's people debating, like, I haven't done the ancestry DNA thing, but I know I've seen other people be like, really? Am I?
Yeah, well,
to test the mummy against a living relative, or you'd still have to dig somebody up.
Well, and that's, I guess that's the question that we left, you know, during the, part four, when that comes out, is there even cause to do that. And if there's not cause to do that, then, and that's, I think, what you guys have been arguing is like, there's not Nate and his, you know, his team, his, they haven't brought enough of a cause to say, oh yeah, you know, we really should probably test that mummy if it's around, or we should test the, you know, we should excavate and test or whatever. Cause there's a legitimate concern here.
I would be very shocked if there wasn't a lock of Edwin Booth's hair somewhere.
But you can't DNA test a lock of hair. Correct. You have to have the follicle.
Oh, gotcha.
I've seen several locks of Edwin's hair, but none of them have the follicle.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to, like, pull a hair.
Gotcha.
Well, I mean, I think we can probably wrap this whole thing up at this point. I mean, I you know, we've done this for now. Well, this will be the fifth episode by the time people hear this, but, you know, we've probably put in, I don't know, there's a couple of 4-hour episodes in there, in those five, and there's a few. So we've put a lot of time and effort into sort of putting this story out there. I think, you know, even hearing Nate tell me, just even off the record or whatever, saying that he's very pleased with how, you know, how much time we gave him, and we didn't cut anything, and we didn't, you know, we put it out there. Most of the time people obviously get interviewed for shows, and Dave, you know this, and Eric, you probably know this too, like, they'll interview you for 3 or 4 hours and then you'll be in there for like a 30-second snippet, and then that's it. And so we try to, you know, put the whole thing out there for people so they get the whole complete picture. But I think it started for us, it was like a start stop. We were covering this for, it feels like the second time we covered it, and I do say that, I think, in the show, it's like we've covered this twice, almost, feel like once unofficially, maybe halfway, and then we had to do that audible, and then now we've covered it and finalized it. So my thought on the whole thing is I'm glad it's behind us. Like, it, you know, we had this like commitment hanging over our head for a long time, and we wanted to get it out there because we promised people, like Dave, you know, when we talked to Dave initially, and like Nate and all those people that we sort of committed to.
I know Dave was super bummed whenever we cut it the first time.
Yeah. He probably
he was sitting around like, you know, I was promised a Vanished podcast on Booth and I didn't get it. And I'm just
Well, he got it now.
Yeah. Well, I had a lot of respect for you guys delaying that conversation because of the political conversation that was happening last summer, and just the hot button topic that Booth is. I think that was really smart to wait, and I applaud you guys for that. I think you made the right call, out of sensitivity of the environment. I wanted to wrap up by saying I find a lot of similarities between this case and the body of Osama bin Laden. You have a person who is a fugitive who's committed a national tragedy. We as a country wanted them gone. When the government finally said they caught them, they had the body, and then apparently the body was dumped at sea. And now you have people then denying that Osama bin Laden was ever killed. And so I find a lot of parallels to those two cases and the theory that Booth's body was dumped on the boat that happened. It again goes to what is the motivation behind lying about it, and what would the embarrassment be if that lie was disproven? Why would our government lie that Osama bin Laden was dead just to have him turn up in public and be like, oh, we lied. Sorry, everybody. That's not something Edwin Stanton would have done.
Very last thing I'll ask for the roundtable here tonight is harkening back to Mark Zaid and what he said, and I'll just kind of rephrase it. Why do we care? Why do we keep talking about this? Why do we have this podcast all this time after this happened? Dave, you feel this stuff all the time. It's like you said, it's constant. It's like you wish it would go away. Why doesn't it go away? Why do people care so much, like, you know, from the general public standpoint, for shows like, you know, Histories, Mysteries, and Unsolved Mysteries and all that stuff? Like, why does that, you know, why does that matter when it comes to John Wilkes Booth and whether or not he died or didn't die that night?
I have a good colleague named Steve Miller who several of the articles to discredit some of the people who said they were at Garrett's farm I sent to Jen. And he years ago told me, he's like, this thing is a rubber spider. You can't kill it, but it was never alive. And so that's how I always think about this, is like, it's never going to go away. You know, and that's why when we, you know, asked about the DNA test, even when those results would come back against the conspiracy theorists, it's not going to go away. It's not going to die, because there is this distrust of the government, of something. There's a want to believe in something pulling the strings, both in good times and bad, and therefore it's more reassuring to us. And Jen and I have had the same conversation about just conspiracy theories overall and why it's so easy for people to agree with them, because it just adds, the locus of control is beyond you. And that's comforting when we can blame someone else. And the distrust of governments and the desire to believe that everything, that you know the truth about something that no one else does, I think that leads a lot of the people into this. And so I felt like I was very harsh on Nate, and that was never like my intention when I was listening, because I enjoyed learning. I mean, I enjoy this stuff. I've been to Enid. Like, I went there, I stood in the room where David E. George offed himself. I've always referred to this thing as pseudo history. because it's something that, you know, wouldn't that we'd want to believe because it's compelling and an exciting story. But I think that's why we talk about it. It's never going to go away because it is interesting and the shows are going to try to grab it because it brings people in. And it's frustrating because, you know, you dig just under the surface, you know, it's not there, but that's the case in everything. I mean, we have conspiracy theories about everything and not even just conspiracy theories. There's things we believe about the past that are absolutely not true. And, you know, Eric, you know this, of course, from all your stuff you've done for 1865, there's assumptions that we make about the time period that are just not true. And we're okay with it because it's like, oh, whatever, this is the story we've had. And so you don't challenge it. And so for a lot of history, you know, that's where we make breakthroughs when we do challenge it. You know, Nate, he kept saying, the reason I'm doing this is I want you to know you can challenge, you can look into these things. Don't be afraid to dig. Yeah. And I agree with him wholeheartedly in that. Like, absolutely. I really do. And it's just, but it's the critical thinking thing that Steve was talking about earlier that, you know, you have to also do that at the same time. If you just dig and dig and dig, you're going to start believing everything you find without being able to realize, is this a legitimate source or not? And so it's going to still be there, but shows like this, you know, helped teach that critical thinking. And that's the best that we can do, is to use this as a source of education for people to really think about these things that you think you believe or that it seems so right on the surface. How do you know?
Yeah, you have to be able to look at all the evidence on the table and make a judgment. And not just look at the evidence that contradicts what you're saying and then say, well, I haven't found a reason for why that's the case yet, but I'm going to find something to disprove that. Then you're just twisting yourself and your logic to try to, it's QAnon as we keep talking about. It's
making that all of these random so much. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I mean, not to compare the two, but it's similar to what's happening in QAnon.
It is.
The fact that they throw a bunch of random points on the board and then connect the dots. And it's exciting with conspiracy theories to feel like you're in on the secret and you're helping to uncover this thing that no one knows. And it's easy to get wrapped up in that and to be excited by that. As you guys have said, it's important to be skeptical and to question. And that's, again, why you have the show. And that's why it's so important to have these conversations. But you have to be able to look at all the evidence on the table and make a logical final verdict from all of the evidence.
Yeah, you are not going to sit here. Like, I am never going to tell you trust the government. Like, you know this about me, Chris. Like, I don't trust the government. Like, I don't. It is my job not to trust the government. And so I'm the last person to want to get on the show and say, that's what they said, and you have to trust it. And I'm super critical of anyone that would dare question, you know, like, that's not me at all. But at the same time, like, that is one of the things that I do think I took away from law school, is how to, like, be a better critical thinker and, like, really, really dissect, like, does this make sense?
Just because you want something to be true doesn't make it true. And I think it's hard for people. I mean, we have to have that in history more than anything, because there's this desire to have history fit our worldview. And you see that because you have, like, the, you know, the partisan hacks who write their books about history and they frame it within the context of what their modern view of life should be. And it's, you know, it's like tribalism with history, and you can do it because you can find sources to support anything. Like, I could make any theory and I could nitpick the sources that I want to justify it. History has to have some disconnect that if you want to try to see it for what it is, and we'll never really be able to see it because we weren't there and we have too many perspectives to really know. But if you can even come close to glimpsing it, you have to remove yourself from the equation. It's not, I want this, I want it to be this way. It's, what do the sources tell me? What do they honestly tell me? And even if that goes against what we want it to be, that is what historical inquiry is to see where it leads us. And sometimes it leads us to figuring out that all of our conclusions are wrong, that everything we thought is not true. And that's disheartening and it's depressing, but that's what history is. It's not about us, it's about the past.
And here's the thing that's scary to me, is how are people 50, 100 years from now going to unpack our history today, when everything is digital, like, we don't write letters to each other like we used to. We don't print out physical photographs like we used to. All of my pictures are on my phone and on my social media.
Yeah.
Where is our information going to be accessible? How do they know that what they're looking at is not a deep fake video or picture or edit? We're getting to a time where history documentation is becoming more and more impossible. Because we're not documenting ourselves, and there's such a massive amount of information. Even the pictures that I took in the last month It's not like the 1800s or you know, where a family member has six photos of their family in their album. Yeah, even documenting your own family history is going to be really hard. How do you pass on your social media account to your children? It's kind of scary who's writing our history.
So yeah, with that being said, we're going to, before we get further into the weeds, I think we're going to wrap up our journey into 1865 and John Wilkes Booth for now.
And so that's it. So far this season, we've covered serial killers and assassins. So where will we go next? Well, perhaps it's only fitting that in a season full of bad men, we cover perhaps the baddest pirate of all time. A name I'm sure you've never heard of, but one that's synonymous with the word piracy. On March 20th, we travel even further back in time to tell you a story of a man that influenced some of the biggest names in all of pirate history. Most vanishings aren't worth a whole hell of a lot when it comes to sheer volume. But this one is worth somewhere north of $130 million. Some people say even more. Get your treasure maps ready. In 3 weeks, we go hunting. See you next time. This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Vanished. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/vanishedpod, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @vanishedpod. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your co-hosts for Vanished are Jennifer Taylor and Chris Williamson. The show is produced by Vanessa Williamson, mastered by TJ Cunahan, and edited by me, Chris Williamson. Music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opening theme for Season 2, Satisfied, is performed by Amber Farnden. The opinions on Vanished are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Inc. Chris Evan Films, Inc. is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Vanished is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Inc. and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Inc. All rights reserved. Vanished is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2021. All rights reserved.